Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star and then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Kate, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect workshop, Gastric Cancer, Current Perspectives and Treatment Options. This is a very important program that we're offering today and with lots of information, and it's a program that we would like to offer more often because it is important for you to be as up-to-date as possible about gastric cancer. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and because of that collaboration and because of your interest in this topic, we have over 626 participants on the call today. And you come from all over the United States, from all different parts of this country. And we also have international participants from Canada, India, Venezuela, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world, and we're delighted that you have joined us today. Today's program has been made possible by grants from Genentech, a member of the Roche Group, and Eli Lilly and Company, and I really want to thank them for their support of the program and for their collaborative partnership in making this possible. I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information about the program itself, our speakers, and the topics we'll be addressing. And there also is information about all the different collaborating organizations as a resource for each of you. And in addition, there's an evaluation form. And I'm going to ask all of you to take a moment at the end of today's program and complete those evaluation forms. They take just about a minute or two to complete. And they are very important to us because they help us to know and to learn from you what topics and programs you would like us to offer going forward. So indeed, today's program, and it's actually the first time we've done a program on gastric cancer, is a program that many of you have asked us to do, and so we're doing it. And so we take your recommendations very seriously. And so please tell us what you'd like us to do, and we will try very hard to implement your suggestions. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. David Ryan. And Dr. Ryan is Chief Division of Hematology Oncology, Clinical Director, Massachusetts General Hospital Cancer Center. He's Director, Tucker Gosnell Center for Gastrointestinal Cancers, and Associate Professor of Medicine, Harvard Medical School. Dr. Ryan is going to address an overview of gastric cancer, including diagnosing and staging, and current standard of care and new treatment approaches. And he's also going to address the role of clinical trials, controlling symptoms and pain, and the importance of communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Ryan.
Thank you very much for having me on this afternoon's program. So the first thing to talk about when talking about gastric cancer are the terms that we use. So the stomach, when we talk about stomach cancer or gastric cancer, the stomach is the organ between the esophagus and the duodenum. So when you swallow food, it goes into your esophagus and then passes into your stomach and then eventually passes into the duodenum, which is the first part of the small intestine. So when we say the word stomach cancer, we're actually referring to that organ, the stomach, between the esophagus and the duodenum. We're not referring to the entire abdomen like we do with our kids when we say somebody has a stomach ache. We're actually referring to the organ between the esophagus and the duodenum. And that lining of that organ is called the gastric mucosa or gastric lining. Now, the interesting thing about stomach cancer is that over the last 25 years, the vast majority of stomach cancers are happening in the upper stomach within several centimeters of the esophagus. The other interesting thing that's happening is that in esophageal cancer, the vast majority of esophageal cancers are happening in the lower esophagus within several centimeters of the stomach. Now, border between the stomach and the esophagus is called the gastroesophageal junction. And for short, we often call it the GE junction. Now, why is that important? The reason why it's important is that the vast majority of esophageal and gastric cancers in the United States are arising within several centimeters of the GE junction, of the gastroesophageal junction. And so we in the medical field we'll lump them together and call them GE junction tumors. We actually don't know why these tumors are all happening within the several centimeters of the stomach, but it's something that we've observed, and people have theories about why that's happening, but nobody knows for sure why it is. When you lump together gastric and esophageal cancers, the incidence of gastric and esophageal cancer in the United States, it's actually a very common cancer in the sense that it's the fifth most common serious cancer that men get, and it's the eighth most common serious cancer that women get. So if you have a loved one that has gastroesophageal cancer, or you yourself has gastroesophageal cancer, you are not alone. The clinics that see gastrointestinal cancer patients are unfortunately full of people who have gastric and esophageal cancer. So what happens when somebody gets diagnosed with these? How do they present? Well, typically they have symptoms that have been occurring over the course of several months, say somewhere between 2 and 4 or 5 months. And those symptoms can be worsening heartburn, indigestion, sometimes some nausea. Sometimes people will present with blood in their stool that gets tested. Often because it's blood coming from the upper GI tract, it's black and tarry stool. But classically, the symptoms are of upper gastrointestinal distress or nausea, indigestion, those kinds of symptoms. And then the patient comes into the primary care doc, often complaining of these symptoms, and the diagnostic evaluation is typically that of an upper endoscopy. And that is the same as a colonoscopy, except you go through the mouth to look at the esophagus and look at the stomach. And the gastroenterologist, during the time of the upper endoscopy, will find a tumor or nodule or mass somewhere at the GE junction or in the actual stomach, and will biopsy that tumor or nodule, and then several days later, it will come back, the report will come back showing typically a type of cancer called adenocarcinoma. Adenocarcinomas are just cancers that arise in duct-forming organs. The vast majority of cancers arising in the gastrointestinal tract, because it's one big long duct, are adenocarcinomas. So once somebody has a diagnosis of adenocarcinoma, you are referred at that point to the medical oncologist and the surgical oncologist and the radiation oncologist. And typically what the staging criteria will be for the medical oncologist will be to figure out how advanced this tumor is. And these tumors typically present in one of three ways. They're either very small and localized and caught very early, and that would be called a localized or a stage one gastric cancer. They are locally advanced, which means that they have spread through the wall of the stomach or esophagus, or are in the surrounding lymph nodes, and those are stage 2 and 3 stomach and esophageal cancers, or GE cancers, and those are called locally advanced, or they have spread to some other site. The most common sites that these cancers tend to spread are someplace else in the abdomen, someplace in the lungs, or someplace in the bones. So typically, a PET CT of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis will be done to assess whether this is small and localized, locally advanced, or metastatic. Occasionally, when we're trying to figure out if something is very localized, a test called an endoscopic ultrasound will be done. That's almost exactly the same as an upper endoscopy, except at the end of the scope is a small ultrasound probe that the physician will use to determine whether that tumor is really confined to the wall or has spread through the wall of the esophagus or stomach. So classically, the staging methods are, number one, an upper endoscopy, and number two, a PET CT of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis, and possibly, three, an upper endoscopy with an ultrasound or endoscopic ultrasound. So once these cancers are diagnosed and people are staged, our treatment is directed as to whether somebody has localized disease, locally advanced, or metastatic disease. Now, the only way to cure these cancers is to cut them out when they're localized or locally advanced. gastric and esophageal cancers are not curable once they're metastatic. But when somebody has localized or locally advanced cancers, they are very curable. And in the United States, anyway, the vast majority of people will present with locally advanced disease. And that's because people don't get symptoms when these are small tumors. They get symptoms when they tend to be a little bit larger and a little bit more advanced. So the vast majority of people will have the tumor either spread through the wall of the stomach or have the presence of cancer in the regional lymph nodes around the stomach. We know that when we take people straight to surgery, that there's a high risk of that cancer coming back. And so often we will add chemotherapy and radiation to the standard treatment paradigm. Now it gets a little confusing here. And the reason it gets a little confusing is that for years we were treating esophageal and gastric cancers differently. In the esophagus, we typically would like to give the chemotherapy and the radiation before the surgery. And in the stomach, we typically, for patients with stomach cancer, we would typically give chemotherapy and radiation after the surgeon had taken out the stomach with either a procedure called a partial gastrectomy or a procedure called a total gastrectomy. So it's often, from the patient's perspective, very confusing as to how we sequence the chemotherapy, the radiation, and the surgery. What has happened over the last 25 years is that because most of these tumors are within several centimeters of the GE junction, the gastroesophageal junction, we've started to treat most of these cancers like esophageal cancers, where people get chemotherapy and radiation prior to the surgery as opposed to getting it after the surgery. But your physicians, the surgeon, the medical oncologist, and the radiation oncologist will sit down with you and figure out what the best sequence is for you. It turns out that while there may be some controversy as to which is the best sequence, what I like to tell patients is that for most patients who have localized or locally advanced tumors of the stomach or GE junction, that you're going to get all three, and it doesn't seem to matter which sequence you get the treatments in, because what we want to do is give you, the patient, the best chance at the best case scenario. And so once people have a diagnosis and then they have a treatment plan, it's very important to set up a great line of communication with your providers, because the standard treatment with chemotherapy and radiation lasts for approximately 6 weeks, and then it takes 6 weeks to recuperate from that and then go to surgery. For patients who go to surgery first, it takes about 6 weeks to recuperate from surgery, and then you get roughly 6 weeks of chemo radiation and 4 months of chemotherapy postoperatively. And so these are the two standard ways that people are treating stomach and gastroesophageal cancers right now. Now, let me just say a word about the surgery. This is one of the more difficult surgeries that cancer surgeons do perform. And so the recovery from this kind of surgery is often a long process. Most people are in the hospital for about a week after the surgery, and then they go home and you're hanging around the house for another week or two. By about the second to third week, you feel well enough to get up and get to the store and maybe pick up some milk and bread and eggs and that kind of thing, but usually not much more. I usually tell patients that they won't feel like working for at least 6 weeks after the surgery. What winds up happening is patients say at about the 3 month mark, they say, "Oh, I feel normal now," but then at the 6 month mark, they tell me, "Gee whiz, I didn't really feel all that normal at 3 months, but now at 6 months, I feel very normal." It also takes a while to get used to the new plumbing, as we say. The surgeons will hook up the esophagus to either part of the stomach or hook up the esophagus to the duodenum. And so that takes a while to get used to eating again. And it's very important to work with the nutritionist and the nurses in clinic in terms of your diet and in terms of strategies to help and help maintain your weight and help maintain your calories. The other thing that people get very concerned about is weight loss after the surgery. And what I like to tell folks is, you just went through a gastric bypass type of procedure. We expect that people are going to lose 10 to 20% of their weight. So if they came in at 200 pounds, I expect them to be at least losing 20 pounds after the surgery and having a new normal. And so now you're going to be 180 or 170 or even 160, and that's okay. People come out to a new normal weight for them after about 3 months. And so expect to lose a lot of weight. It doesn't necessarily mean bad things that people are losing weight. It's as though you went through gastric bypass surgery, and that's the way to think about it in your own mind. And you have to get used to looking at the new skinny you in the mirror, because really you're going to look like you did when you were 18 years old in some cases. And that can be both gratifying but in some ways scary when you're looking at yourself in the mirror. Now, there are some new treatments for stomach cancer. One of the things that you should ask your physicians about is, do I have a HER2-positive stomach cancer? What is HER2? HER2, or HER2, is a protein that gets overexpressed or amplified in about 10% of patients with stomach cancer. It's the same protein that gets overexpressed or amplified in breast cancer, and it's the same protein to which we have an antibody treatment called trastuzumab that we can add to the therapy, at least for people with stage 4 stomach and esophageal cancer, and it actually markedly improves the overall survival. Now, you might ask, what if I don't have stage 4? What if I have localized or locally advanced stomach cancer? What's the role of trastuzumab or Herceptin if I have a HER2 overexpressing or amplified tumor of the stomach and I have stage 1, 2, or 3 gastric cancer? Well, we don't know just yet, but there are clinical trials underway. And so it's very important to discuss those types of clinical trials with your physicians if you have that type of stomach cancer. And it's very important that your physicians test for that type of protein expression, the HER2 protein expression. One, because it's now the standard of care to add trastuzumab to chemotherapy if you have stage 4 stomach or esophageal cancer. And there are ongoing clinical trials that will tell us whether it will be helpful or not for people with earlier stage stomach or gastric cancer. And let me just say a word about the overall role of clinical trials. Clinical trials are the only means where we make things better for people. And so it's really important that you discuss clinical trials with your physicians, because the way we make things better, the way we discover better ways to treat people, is through clinical trials. Let me finish with several words about controlling symptoms and working with your team to help control those symptoms. One of the things about stomach and esophageal cancer, particularly if it's a locally advanced tumor, is that people can experience something called a gastric outlet obstruction. Gastric outlet obstruction is when the tumor obstructs the stomach so that food and liquid can't go from the esophagus into the duodenum. So what happens? The stomach is often a very distensible or balloon-like organ. And so the stomach can fill up with fluid and more fluid and more fluid, and then all of a sudden you reach a tipping point and people have to throw up. And they can often get nauseous out of the blue and throw up, and that's called a gastric outlet obstruction. And that obstruction has to be relieved. And that can be relieved in several different ways. For tumors in the esophagus or the GE junction, sometimes we put in a stent to open up that obstruction. They actually go in with the upper endoscope, the gastroenterologist, and they actually put a stent in the lower esophagus to open up that obstructing process. If the tumor is lower down in the stomach, sometimes the stents don't work. In fact, the stents aren't very effective for tumors that are actually in the stomach. And often those patients will need to have something called a gastric bypass procedure or a gastrojejunostomy, where a loop of jejunum is brought up and sewed into the stomach so that fluid and food can pass around that particular obstruction. Sometimes doing that surgery can be problematic, and so one of the things that we sometimes do for symptomatic relief, because it's really hard to control the nausea when somebody has a gastric outlet obstruction, oftentimes the medicines we use with chemotherapy, like Zofran, they don't work all that well, and people will need to have a gastric tube to help decompress their stomach. The last thing to talk about is nutrition. Obviously, for people who have tumors of the upper gastrointestinal system, like the stomach and the esophagus, getting adequate nutrition can be really hard. And so sometimes we have to use a feeding tube, or a J-tube for jejunum, a feeding tube. And sometimes we have to use IV nutrition called TPN, total parenteral nutrition, to get people through the treatment process. And so I'll finish there, and I'll be available for questions later on in the show.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Ryan. That was really just a very comprehensive presentation on gastric cancer, and I know there will be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. And our next speaker is Diana Bearden, and Diana is Supervisor of Clinical Nutrition, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, and she's a registered dietitian. And Ms. Bearden is going to address nutritional concerns and eating tips. And it's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Ms. Bearden.
Thank you, Carolyn. Yes, and most treatments for gastric cancer have to be from surgery, radiation, or chemotherapy, just like Dr. Ryan was mentioning, can affect your eating. These treatments can increase your need for nutrition and may require some diet modifications. Like Dr. Ryan just closed with, is nutrition support in the form of a feeding tube or even parenteral nutrition may be indicated. But eating well during your treatment can lower your fatigue, improve your fatigue level, by giving you the nutrition to keep your strength up as well as maintaining your weight. And patients who maintain their nutrition tend to tolerate treatments better and have a faster recovery than those who don't. But excessive weight loss can result in treatment delays, breaks in treatment, and slow the healing process. The main nutritional goal during your treatment is to avoid weight loss and preserve your lean muscle mass. And this goal can be achieved by working with your healthcare team and your dietitian to modify your diet as needed. So weight loss is a common side effect during gastric cancer treatments, and this is mainly due to decreased food intake, and this can be related to feeling a fullness. A lot of patients just feel full and don't feel like they can eat anymore. Some have issues with indigestion. And then if you've had surgery, changes in the anatomy postoperatively, or even influence from the tumor itself can affect your ability to take in enough nutrition. So a few ways to halt or minimize the weight loss is by consuming small, frequent meals, 5 to 6 small meals a day rather than 3 large meals. Cooking your vegetables until they are very tender, and I give patients the example of fork tender. What the heat does is it helps break down the insoluble fiber and improves the digestion, because our stomach kind of acts like a grinder, and the more fiber we eat, not only does it fill us up, but it causes more work at that part of our digestive tract. So peeling your fruits or even eating canned fruits can be helpful in reducing the amount of insoluble fiber as well. Reducing the amount of fat in your diet by avoiding fried, greasy foods and avoiding the use of excessive gravies and sauces can also help. Fat requires more digestion. It stays in your stomach longer. And a lot of times when food sits in your stomach longer, your increased risk of having more indigestion and the feeling of being bloated is there. You can still have fat in your diet, but we just want to modify the amount of it. Chewing your foods well is very important. Like I mentioned earlier, stomach acts like a grinder a little bit. So the better we chew our food, the easier it will be for us to tolerate it. Sitting up when you eat and staying up after you have eaten is also very important in helping digestion, hopefully reducing an incident of reflux. and reduce the amount of fluid you consume with your meals. Limiting your drinking to between meals can be very helpful. Not only do we not want you filling up on fluid when you may be challenged as it is, but a lot of times the fluids we drink don't have a lot of calories in them, so we don't want to utilize the space in our stomach to fill up on fluids that aren't going to, number one, provide a lot of nutritional benefit or calories. If you've had a total gastrectomy, you may experience something called dumping syndrome. This is when food enters into the small intestine too quickly, and symptoms such as diarrhea, fullness, abdominal cramping, and bloating can be experienced by patients, even sweating, anxiety, and nausea. By following the above, the previous suggestions that I mentioned, in addition to avoiding extreme temperatures, such as very hot foods or hot liquids, can help reduce this from happening, and also avoiding highly sweetened or sugary foods, and this also includes things like fruit juices and cakes, candies, cookies, and desserts, like things like that. The most important thing, if you're struggling with maintaining your weight or tolerating food, keep a daily food record of what you're taking in. Not only will it make you aware of how often and how much you're eating, but it can also help target when certain foods are giving you uncomfortable side effects and help your healthcare team with making other suggestions. Feeding tubes can be placed at any time during your treatment, and patients who are underweight coming into treatment may be a candidate for this prior to things starting up, or those who have lost the ability to really consume foods. So it's not unlikely that patients may have a duodenostomy tube placed. For others, you may not necessarily start at that point, but based on your tolerance to treatment, a feeding tube might be indicated. And a feeding tube is not considered to be a long-term need for nutrition with somebody who's being treated for gastric cancer. It's a short-term intervention, and you can eat while you are receiving nutrition from a feeding tube as long as there's no other issues going on as far as an obstruction or something like that. But it'll be good for patients to continue to try and consume foods to get their tolerance improved and still having the satisfaction in social connection with others. But always remember to communicate concerns and issues with your healthcare team so they can assist in addressing them quickly and easing a lot of the anxiety you might be experiencing. That's all I have, and Carolyn, I'm going to pass it back to you.
Well, thank you very much for lots of really helpful hints to everybody, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Elizabeth Ezra, and Liz is an oncology social worker, and she is program coordinator for cancer care. And Liz is going to review with you the free services that you can access from cancer care, as well as the important role of support groups. And it's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Liz.
Thank you, Carolyn. I am an oncology social worker, and I work with many people with gastric cancer and their loved ones. I would like to begin by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer and how cancer care can be a part of that network. There are many ways we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care's programs, including individual counseling, support groups, either over the telephone or online, education about resources and how to navigate the healthcare system, practical help and some limited financial assistance, as well as some chemo copayment assistance, are provided by licensed master's level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends. They are also trained to help cancer patients and their families tackle the problems that accompany the disease, such as the financial demands, the physical changes, social adjustment, and the psychological impact and care. Adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. Cancer affects the whole person and the entire family. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. Joining a support group is a way to connect with others who are going through a similar situation and have similar problems. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. Support groups are a safe place where you can voice your concerns and your fears. Feeling well emotionally can help you better deal with the diagnosis and the treatment. At this time, Cancer Care offers a general support group over the telephone and for both patients and caregivers, as well as online groups for caregivers. We have a unique young adult care group as well. If you are interested in any of the Cancer Care services, please call us on our HOPE line at 1-800-813-HOPE or 4673, or on our website at www.cancercare.org. Our website is very comprehensive and can help you find a lot of additional information on your cancer diagnosis and the treatments you need to receive. As we have learned today from today's program, there's a lot of information to digest and to get your arms around. Our social workers can help you understand what it means for you and your family. Your social worker can help you prioritize and actually rehearse the questions you might want to ask to get the answers and the information you need. Please remember that you are not alone. Cancer Care Services are there to help you. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to talk to you today.
Well, thank you very much, Liz, for just really providing people with information about our services at Cancer Care and how important that support can be. And now we have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask actually Kate to bring all of our speakers on board, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. And if we don't get to your question, please call us at the end of the call at 1-800-813-4673, and I'll repeat that number again. But for now, let's see if we can take as many of your questions as possible, and both the questions on the phone and online. And Kate, if you could bring all of our speakers on board and explain to everybody how to queue up for questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. And again, ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone.
So I have a question from one of our online participants. My family has a history of gastric cancer. Is there anything I should be doing in terms of with my healthcare team? Dr. Brian, if you could address that question.
Sure. So there are inherited syndromes in which gastric cancer is a prominent type of cancer that people can get. And so if your family does have a history of gastric cancer, you should bring that up with your primary care physician. A thorough family history should be taken. And if there are any questions, then your local major medical center will have a group of experts here at Mass General. We're called the Center for Cancer Risk Assessment, but they're called different names across the country. But there are experts in inherited predispositions to cancer, and you can consult one of those groups.
Excellent. And another question from one of our online participants is, what types of stomach cancer surgery are available? Dr. Ryan?
So when a tumor is very small and very localized, you can do local excision endoscopically of that particular cancer. The vast majority of cancers that we see in the United States, however, are more advanced than small and localized, and so most patients are not don't have cancers that are amenable to a local resection. These are major surgeries. Typically, they're divided into a partial gastrectomy, where some of the stomach is left, and a total gastrectomy, where the entire stomach is removed. There are technical reasons why you may be amenable as a patient to one or the other surgery. At the end of the day, though, you want the right cancer, you want the right surgery that's right for your particular cancer, and The symptoms from a total gastrectomy as opposed to a partial gastrectomy, surprisingly, are not that different, and really shouldn't affect your decision making.
There's another question from one of our online participants, and it's similar to another question we had about family history. But my husband was recently diagnosed with gastric cancer. What steps can I take to reduce the risk of gastric cancer for our children? So again, if you could comment on that, Dr. Ryan.
Sure. So I think the first would be is to ask your physicians the question of, does your husband have an inherited predisposition to stomach cancer? In patients who have an inherited predisposition to stomach cancer, something like hereditary non-polyposis colon cancer, or HMPCC, or the CDH gene, for those patients, their family members can be tested to see if they have inherited that predisposition as well, that gene mutation. And if they do have it, they can enter into a screening program of regular upper endoscopies. If the physicians can't find an inherited predisposition, there's actually a lot of disagreement in the community as to whether first-degree family members, like children, should be screened beginning at about 10 years before the earliest member in the family had that cancer. It certainly would be something that's very reasonable to do, however. For instance, in Japan, where there's a very high incidence of gastric cancer, they do upper endoscopies like we do colonoscopies here in the United States in terms of screening. So screening does work in instances where there's a high risk of that type of stomach cancer.
Excellent. Thank you. And so another question from one of our online participants, from Lisa. In stage 4 gastric cancer, is chemotherapy the first treatment that is indicated versus radiation? If chemo is initiated, how quickly will tumor response be evaluated? So if you can answer that question in a general way.
Sure. So typically we only use surgery or radiation to treat symptoms when somebody has stage 4 gastric cancer. So if we need to fix a particular symptom like a gastric outlet obstruction or like a painful bone metastasis, we will use surgery and sometimes radiation in the instance of the painful bone metastasis, for sure radiation, as the first means of therapy. However, our goal for somebody who has stage 4 gastric cancer is to get them on chemotherapy as quickly as we can. And so chemotherapy is the mainstay of treatment for stage 4 disease.
Okay. And another question that we have is, a question about clinical trials that are recommended for stomach cancer. If you could kind of go over that in even more detail.
Sure. So at every step along the way, there's only three things that you can do as an oncologist and as a patient. And so these are the three options you should always discuss with your oncologist. The first is, what if I do nothing in terms of treating the cancer? What if I do no chemotherapy, no radiation, no surgery, nothing? What will happen? That's an incredibly important question to ask. Some cancers are so slow growing that doing nothing is the right thing. Second, what is considered the standard of care? So if I were to go to Great Medical Center in Boston and go to a Great Medical Center in San Francisco or in Texas, what would those folks consider to be the standard of care? Always ask that question. And then the third thing you can do for anybody is, okay, what are the available clinical trials? What are the big questions that people are asking? So, for instance, one of the big questions that people are asking in stages 1 through 3 of stomach cancer is, for those folks who have HER2 overexpression, does adding trastuzumab or Herceptin to the treatment make a difference in curing patients? That's an enormously important question that we're trying to answer. There are other clinical trials. For instance, in stage 4 stomach cancer, we need to find new therapies. And we have a number of different clinical trials that we're evaluating new drugs in stage 4 stomach cancer. Am I a candidate for that cancer? Is that cancer as good as standard therapy? Is that clinical trial potentially as good as standard therapy? What if I do nothing in terms of actively treating the cancer at this particular point? How does that compare with doing the clinical trial in terms of the logistics and the potential side effects? So I would say the most important question you can ask your physician at any step along the way is, what happens if I do nothing to treat the cancer? What happens if I do what's considered standard to treat the cancer? And what are the available clinical trials here or someplace else that are exciting that you would consider to treat this cancer if you had this type of cancer? So that's the way I tell patients to approach the issue of clinical trials.
Excellent. Another question that we have from one of our online participants is actually the kind of what's new in stomach cancer research. Again, if you could, obviously a lot of interest in the research in this area. If you could say a little bit more about that as well.
Sure. So in stomach cancer research, I would say there's three areas of research to pay attention to over the next 10 to 20 years. First area is why are these tumors that are several centimeters within the GE junction, the gastroesophageal junction, why are they increasing and why have they increased over the last 20 to 25 years? Is it something about the obesity epidemic? Is it something related to something we're eating or in the environment? That's a question that nobody knows the answer to right now, and everybody in the science community is trying to figure out. It's the holy grail of causation science for gastric and esophageal cancers right now. The second area of research, I would say, is looking at new drugs. There's several new drugs that are being tried in stomach cancer in terms of angiogenesis inhibition and also in terms of several different antibodies that are being targeted at specific overexpressed proteins in stomach cancer. Those are very interesting and interesting enough to ask your oncologist about them, particularly if you have stage 4 stomach cancer. And then the third area of research to keep your eye on over the next 10 years is what are the different types of stomach cancer genetically? What are the different mutations that happen in stomach cancer, and can we target those mutations or overexpressed pathways with different inhibitors of those pathways the same way that we're doing now in lung cancer, the same way we're doing in breast cancer, and the same way we're doing in colon cancer?
Excellent. Thank you. And so another question which I'm going to actually ask perhaps everyone to address, but it's recently diagnosed with gastric cancer. What about weight loss when my treatments start? How am I going to deal with those? So I'm going to ask Dr. Ryan if you would start with that, and then Diana Baird, and then Liz, just in terms of just the emotional adaptation to the concept of weight loss.
So I think the biggest question we get with regards to weight loss is after surgery. People do lose 10 to 20% of their body weight after these surgeries, and the main thing that I do is reassure patients that it's okay. It's okay to weigh 20 to 40 pounds less than you used to weigh, and everything's going to be okay after these surgeries and after your new normal weight gets established. I think that we work hand-in-hand with the nutritionist to make sure that people are getting adequate calories. But once they're getting adequate calories, in the immediate, say, 6-month period after the surgery, I reassure them that as long as they're taking in adequate calories, their brain is setting this new normal weight for them. And all of this research that we now understand comes out of the gastric bypass research for patients who are obese. We now understand that a new normal is being set by complex neurohormonal interactions between the brain and the intestines, and it's okay to lose 10 to 20% of your body weight after one of these major surgeries.
Excellent. Thank you. And Diana, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, obviously echoing what Dr. Ryan said, and, you know, one of the roles that the dietitian can help with, like Dr. Ryan said, is in directing the patient on how many calories, how much protein they need, for good nutrition, but, you know, also talking with them, a lot of times patients are upset about how their body image has changed a little with their weight loss, because a lot of times when you have extreme weight changes and weight loss, they lose some of the muscle mass. And so what we try to do is direct patients towards a healthy diet and working towards rebuilding that muscle mass so that they have not only the weight back, but also the way their body's the composition is to help them accomplish their goals. So, yes, absolutely. Over time, that can get back to a point where the patient's comfortable.
Thank you. And Liz, and just in terms of sense of self and the concept of a changed body image, if you want to comment on that.
Well, I think that really varies from person to person. Some people, you know, welcome the fact that they've lost some weight. They wish that they didn't lose it because of an illness or because of surgery, but they, you know, they may like the way they look, and some people don't like the way they look. You know, I find that many of my clients are concerned about whether they have enough energy to do what they need to do every day and whether they have the stamina to be the person that they want to be. So it's not only how they look, but how their body is able to perform for them. And I think that, you know, the one of the biggest lessons of having a serious cancer diagnosis is that you understand that there are some things that you just don't have control over. You know, when you're healthy, you do have control over your weight. When you're dealing with an illness like gastric cancer or the surgeries, you really don't have control. You have to, like, your body will do what it needs to do, and as Dr. Ryan says, you will begin to see a new normal for your weight.
Excellent. Thank you. And another question from one of our online participants, is there a standard vitamin mineral supplementation regimen that is recommended for surgery patients? Does this include vitamin B12? So Dr. Ryan and Diana Barden, do you want to address this?
Yes, I can defer this to Diana, but we always recommend that people are on B12 replacement after gastric cancer surgery, and often people need iron replacement as well.
Exactly, and that's what information we provide patients. And as far as the standard multivitamin supplement, you know, we really encourage patients to get the nutrition from their diet. And if there are deficits or they're having challenges with that, we can talk about that on a one-on-one basis. But definitely the B12 and the iron are the two that that are focused on initially.
Excellent. Thank you. And another question from our online participants. So we really appreciate these really great questions. Can I eat following a full gastrectomy? Dr. Ryan and...
Yes, absolutely. You can eat following a full total gastrectomy. You won't be able to eat as much, though, and so one of the things that people have to get used to is eating frequent small meals throughout the day. And with the help of the nutritionist, we can get people on a regimen that works very well, and they get used to. But there's a social component to eating as well. So that big dinner, that big family dinner where everybody keeps eating for 45 minutes or an hour, you're just not going to be able to do, and you're going to have to pace yourself differently and socially get used to that. And I'd say people struggle with that as much as anything.
Thank you. And Liz, do you want to comment on that too, just the social implications of, because eating is so often very much a part of our social activities to some extent.
Well, I think that your whole family or all of your friends will have to join in with you to understand that you're not who you used to be and that you've made these adjustments. And I sometimes just explaining to people, you know, if you're in a business dinner or you're someplace where you're not with people that you're normally with, just explain to them, you know, I've recently had surgery and I have to eat very, very slowly. So it's not that the food isn't good or that I'm not enjoying myself or enjoying being with you, but I just have to really pace myself and eat very slowly.
Thank you. And the other question that has come up is that are there particular risk factors for developing gastric cancer? Is something that people can be aware of?
So, yes, there are, and it differs as to the location. So for gastroesophageal cancer, we think that the biggest risk factor is something called Barrett's esophagus. Barrett's esophagus is a changing of the lining of the very last portion of the esophagus, and that is diagnosed on upper endoscopy, and it's associated with long-standing heartburn. Now, this is very different from cancers that occur in the body or lower part of the stomach. Cancers in the body of the stomach are associated with H. pylori infection, uh, the the bacterial infection that causes gastric ulcers. And so, interestingly, there has been some evidence that the H. pylori infection might be protective against the gastroesophageal junction cancer. So it gets very complicating in terms of one being preventative and the other being perhaps pro-carcinogenic. And so it's a very confusing time right now in the field with regards to risk factors and prevention.
It sounds like there are a lot of complex issues for people to understand. Do you have any thoughts or recommendations of how people can best get the information that they need for their own specific situation, Dr. Ryan?
Well, I think that, number one, having a great communication with your oncology team is most important. Number two, the United States is blessed with academic medical centers, and if you have a cancer, getting an opinion from somebody who just sees a stomach cancer is a wonderful resource. And number three, there are several resources online, including this resource online, that are tremendous as well. And so I think people can gain access almost anywhere they are within the U.S.
Excellent. And other speakers want to add to this a concept of how people can really become most informed?
Well, I just, I think that we're all the best physician, personal physician for ourselves. We know our bodies, and if you sense that something isn't right, either because of pain or your routines with your bowels or anything like that, it's important to go to the doctor and just not self-medicate by going to the drugstore and buying everything off the shelf, but actually going to the doctor and having a consultation about what could be happening for you.
I agree. I mean, a lot of times I'll talk with patients and they'll say, well, I've been having problems for quite some time and I've just been doing things from over the counter and haven't addressed, the issue early on. And they're frustrated with themselves a little bit because, gosh, I wish I would have done this. So if you notice that something's not normal or it's off your normal path, then definitely, go to your physician and, talk with them about it and don't let time lapse.
And I'm going to ask Dr. Another question that came in online is, are these gastric cancers usually diagnosed at a later point, or are they early stage diagnosed, or is it a kind of a range, or and are there things that could increase earlier detection of gastric cancers?
So the majority of gastric cancers are diagnosed either locally advanced or metastatic. Proportionally, very few in the United States are diagnosed with small localized disease. The exception would be, of course, Japan and Korea, where they have screening endoscopy programs where patients, just like in the United States, when you turn 50, you go get an upper endoscopy. And in Asia, there's a very high incidence of gastric cancer, which justifies this screening. In the United States, typically we don't screen people without symptoms, but if you do have symptoms that your physician is having a difficult time controlling or that they're persistent, one should raise the question of, do I need an upper endoscopy?
Well, I have to say this has been an extraordinary call. I want to thank all of our speakers who've just been really outstanding and really all of you who've actually also all the participants on the call who've posted such really important questions to really address and enhance the call. I want to remind everyone that this is a one-hour workshop and that in planning a program like this, we recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. So I do want to remind all of you that although the program is about to end, the services that you can access from Cancer Care, those will continue endlessly. And you can contact our staff here. And we have a large staff of oncology social workers here who really are here to talk with you, to provide support and counseling, to actually also offer you support groups. We actually have both support groups on the telephone online. We offer practical and financial assistance, And we have, of course, these workshops, these these Connect Education workshops that we offer quite regularly on different topics. And we also have various publications and fact sheets that you can access, and a very robust website as well. So we would encourage you to take advantage of the services that you can access from Cancer Care. Again, they are free. And most importantly, I would not want anyone to think that you're alone when this call ends in coping with gastric cancer or cancer in general. Or any of your concerns. I want you to know that you're part of a community of support, and we are here to help you. And so you may please call us at 1-800-813-4673. Again, 1-800-813-4673, or visit our website at www.cancercare.org. Thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may disconnect. Have a wonderful day.